Waiting to be answered, and we do our best to do just that. We want to whet your appetite for the unknown and get you interested in the questions that are profound and important. I'm Henrik, and welcome to everyone stopping by at redicecreations.com, or maybe you're listening through a network that picks up the program. In any regard, a warm welcome. It's good to have you with us. I hope you're doing well, and I'm certainly happy spring is finally around the corner. Today, Lucy Wyatt returns to the program to discuss the origins of cities, the origins of farming, and domestication of animals. What is the intention of the original civilizations? What happened in the time when mankind went from hunting and gathering to farming, and why? Lucy challenges the accepted views of progress since the end of the Ice Age, and we are going to talk about some interesting data of what happened and the sites that are considered to be the oldest known cities in the world. Lucy studied international relations and Italian at Sussex University. As well as researching the ancient past, she's also interested in earth energies and now leads local Gatekeeper Trust pilgrimages on equinoxes and solstices. She's the author of Approaching Chaos, which examines an alternative, an ancient archetype dating from the Bronze Age that helped cities exist in harmony with nature, something that we can learn from today. This archetype influenced the ancient Greeks and Romans, often mistakenly admired as examples of civilized societies. Welcome back to Red Ice Radio, Lucy Wyatt. It's great to talk to you once again. It was back in 2010 we did our first program with you, and I actually just listened to that one back again. A very interesting program, very good stuff, and I'm looking forward to getting into some of the material here again. Of course, there's new things we want to talk about, but also returning to some of the topics that you have in your book, Approaching Chaos. Very interesting stuff. Welcome back, Lucy. How are you?
Thank you, Henrik. It's a great pleasure to be back. It's fantastic. I can't believe it was as long ago as 2010.
It doesn't feel like it.
No, I know. It's incredible.
It feels like it was 2011 maybe or something like that, but it's going quick. How's England today?
Oh, very nice and sunny today. Beautiful today. Lovely spring day.
Same here. Finally, some spring coming. So.
Yeah, finally.
Yeah. Why don't we do a little kind of recap, if you will, of some of the main ideas, some of the main theses in Approaching Chaos. I think it would be good for people who didn't, heard our first program together, and also just to kind of get things going here today. Tell us the synopsis, if you will.
Yeah, sure, Henrik. Well, essentially, it's a positive message, because essentially what I'm saying is that there's an older way of looking at civilization, an ancient, what I call an archetype, that I think goes back more than 5,000 years ago, goes back beyond Greeks and Romans. We're very stuck with Greeks and Romans, but there's another way of looking at things. The Egyptians were possibly the best example of it, but they weren't the only example. And I do believe that this original way of living life in cities, that's what I'm calling civilization, life is lived in cities, has a very positive message for us that we can so much learn from. Because as we face so many problems now, that's why I titled my book Approaching Chaos, it wasn't meant to be a negative thing. It was meant to be actually saying that things can get better. But I think in order to get better, I think we need to go back to the origins of the earliest ways of thinking about cities and try and understand what they were doing and how they did it and how they thought. That is as much as anything the most important thing. And so that's really where my book goes and goes back into the history, going back to the end of the Ice Age and looking at how cities came about.
So let's talk a little about that, the origins of cities, and when you placed the end of the Ice Age. There's a lot of debate back and forth in this, obviously from some of the alternative theories out there, but when do you place it, Lucy?
Well, it took a long time for the ice to recede, so it took several thousand years, and so we're talking really from about 10,000 BC onwards that we start to see the ice retreating, and the first signs of the beginnings of civilization, not actual cities, but the first signs is the domestication of cereals, the genetic modification of cereals. That's about 9,500 BC. That's really the first point. And the problem that we have, Henrik, is that we have been given a story which is that this change in cereals brought about changes in how people organize themselves socially, and that we've been fed this line that from that early marketplaces and early cities came about. But actually, when you look at the evidence, and this is what my book does, that's idea of a farming experiment leading to these other changes doesn't actually stack up. And there's a particularly critical time at about 5000 BC when you had a domestication of animals, when they changed in size and shape, and it's called the secondary products revolution, this key time, because it's after this that a cow is docile enough for you to take milk to make the secondary products of butter and cheese. And it's after this time that you can take the coat from a sheep and have wool, because before that they had coats like deer. They didn't have useful coats. And you could ride a horse and all those kind of things. And what the mainstream does is it says that those changes in animals allow cities to arrive. And I say it's the other way around. I say it's the change in cities, the arrival of cities, that actually brought about the genetic modification of animals. And that's the really controversial difference of my approach.
And how did that happen? What is the mechanics of that? Are we talking about a form of evolution, a microevolution, actually manipulation in the sense of human hands, or is there something else going on?
Well, that is a really, really difficult question to answer, Henry, because there's no solid evidence of any of this. You won't have to go by circumstantial evidence. And clearly particularly the city of Jericho, where it's clear from the archaeological record that this change occurred over something like 100 years, which is too short a time frame for an evolutionary experience to happen.
Yep.
So that's one thing that one is in that favor. The other thing to say is that Neolithic man had been penning up wild animals for thousands of years for meat and hides, but they had never actually changed. So if taming them was a result of penning them up, that clearly isn't the case, because it would have happened earlier. The other thing is that the change is always conveniently useful. And not only do they change in shape and size and you have different colors come, but it's the key change, a really, really important one, is that these animals change in their heads. They become handleable. They become docile. And people haven't really understood the significance of that. You know, I've had on the farm here where I live everything that can kill you, from a bull to a big horse to a huge pig or whatever. And this is the important thing about the domestication, is that they become creatures that can live with people, and you can move them around, you can work with them. And that wasn't possible before. So it's all too convenient. It's all too useful. And if you're going to be living in a city, it makes sense to have your animals static, because otherwise you've got to follow the herd, haven't you, and hunt in this hunter-gatherer kind of way. And part of what I say is that they must have been different people who did this, because it's a different knowledge set. There's a huge difference between killing things, killing as you hunt them, or keeping them alive, as in stock herding. You know, the hunter-gatherer had one skill set, the farmer had another. And I don't think one comes from the other as an evolutionary experience. I don't think it was an environmental pressure or some other nonsense that the mainstream come up with. You know, they seem to imply that somehow farming is an easier option, whereas actually all the evidence these days from anthropologists shows that hunter-gathering lifestyle is actually a lot easier than the static farming lifestyle.
And tell us something about the diet as well, to, you know, pertaining to this, because that's, you know, some of the neo, you know, more popular theories out there about how humanity is supposed to eat is, of course, looking back into the so-called Stone Age diets, obviously, and compare that to what we are accustomed to now in the Western world, at least, with all the wheat and the bad stuff. It's very detrimental what we're doing here.
That is very true, and actually conferences and that discuss the paleontology of the health of skeletons and things looks at things like ante-mortem teeth decay, and where they compared hunter-gathering societies with the static farming city-based societies, they discover that the health of the bones and all of that, the lack of loss of teeth before death, which is what antemortem decays, is a lot better in the hunter-gatherer societies and a lot worse. And also we've had a change in what they call the bite, whereby the exposure to eating continuously through different generations, highly refined cereals, results in a different formation of the jaw bones, so that what we've developed is an overbite. So our teeth don't actually meet in the middle. Our upper jaw oversails our lower jaw. And this is a direct consequence of eating these highly refined cereals. There's a brilliant man called Galen Weston Price. I don't quote him in my book, but I know of his work, who does a lot of work in the Pacific, looking at how very basic Stone Age diets were so much healthier and people had a proper bite, you know, where the upper jaw met the lower jaw. And so also the whole thing of diseases is that a lot of diseases came about as a result of the shift to farming, because they were carried by animals, things like, you know, chickens and things like that, the flu viruses and all the other diseases. So it was generally quite bad news, in fact, this move to farming. That's very true.
I want to try to get closer to what actually happened in terms of the decision for mankind, if there was solely theirs, of course, to make this move over from hunter-gatherer to farming. But if we just for a moment before we do that, stick with it, just looking at the animals here again. You mentioned it's difficult to pinpoint this change in the brain, in a sense, that you're talking about. I remember reading about articles talking about the fact that if you actually release a domestic pig into the wild, they actually pretty quickly kind of go back almost to their original, you know, boar, swine type of state. They even actually begin to grow hair and tusks and things like that.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, I haven't actually come across that evidence.
What do you think that would mean if we put that into perspective? What is it that locks the animal into the state of being so-called domesticated, then, in a sense?
Well, that's very hard to say exactly. I mean, I'm not a particular expert on genetics, but I do know that if you breed something in order to get something different, you have to breed it with something different. You know, there are still wolves in zoos that haven't morphed into dogs, for example.
Right, yeah.
And also what's so interesting about this, take for example the instance of the wild horse. Now, the wild horse remained the same for thousands of years, the tarpan, and after domestication you had all the different colours and the different breeds of horse then could evolve, appear. So something has to have triggered it in the first place. Maybe, I don't know how they did the original genetic modification. Maybe it was some kind of exposure to some sort of sonic thing. I don't know, I'm just speculating. You know, some kind of vibrational thing. I absolutely haven't got a clue about that.
But it has to be something like that. You reckon that it must be something from our perspective unknown and pretty extraordinary. Is that the case?
I think so. Because you see, the thing is, we have an assumption that there's a kind of natural progress. Even your a point you just made a second ago about what it was that change people from hunter-gatherers to city dwellers. It implies that it's the same people. There's a kind of implicit assumption that, you know, mankind's on this path to progress, and that cities are like a little stage along the path to change. Mm. And I don't think that's the case. I think the case that is more likely is that they are a completely different sort of people. Where they actually originate from, I don't know. And I don't go into that in the book because it's too speculative. It's too difficult. Maybe they were from Atlantis. Who knows? I've no idea. I think it's quite likely that they were the people with the elongated skulls. I unfortunately deleted from an earlier draft references to the elongated skulls. Some friends who read it got a bit spooked by that.
really?
Yeah, it was a bit of a shame, but never mind. Because I want to make my work very accessible to people, which is why, for me, it's very important not to mention things like Atlantis, or, and I keep very much with academic, properly researched material. It's my interpretations that are more controversial. Because I just think there's so much in the actual record that isn't properly explained, because people haven't had the right, correct template. They haven't had a way of looking at it that explains it in any other way. So that's why I kind of steer away from all of that. And I just think that if you look at certain things, like the earlier cities did not grow out of marketplaces. This is a really key point. The people who started the early cities, and we're talking Mesopotamia over 5,000 years ago, probably about 7,000 years, the people who started those cities, the earliest evidence is a shrine. They were priests. They were a priestly elite. And the other thing that makes one so suspicious is that these cities don't grow up randomly as if they would if they were just places of exchange. They are set out. They are laid out into quarters. So there's temples here and markets there and all sorts of things going on in a very structured kind of way. And that in itself should make people sit up and think, oh, my goodness, this is extraordinary. So that in itself, and I just think that those elites existed for themselves. They weren't interested in spreading their ideas to humanity particularly. If you like, do you want me to talk about the contact with the Indo-Europeans?
Sure. I wanted to ask you a little bit about, obviously you just raised some points about the fact that there are different kinds of human beings in the past. For instance, pretty recently there was a discovery of the so-called Red Deer Cave people. This just shows that we have we know that there was Neanderthals in the past. We have these kind of hobbit-type, creatures as well down in the Pacific somewhere, or even Australia, I think, which just shows that there's different kinds of people. Is that possible for the elongated skull people as well? We know there's a manipulation of the skulls to have them look like this, but what you're talking about, obviously, is those who are not manipulated. There seems to be naturally, so to speak, elongated by themselves.
Yeah. Absolutely, the genetic elongation. I know we're going to talk about it later, but this event that I'm organising at the end of April, the Eternal Knowledge Festival, we've got Brian Forster coming over from Peru. He's done a lot of work on the elongated skulls.
That's right. We had him with us, by the way. So regulars here are familiar with this. So go ahead, Lucy.
Yeah. Well, I'm really excited. I'm really looking forward to hearing what Brian's got to say. This is the important thing, and the point is that you don't even need very many of these people. They don't need to leave much trace of themselves around. So if they're an elite, they can be doing all sorts of things that you then get confused, because what's left in the record is the evidence of what they tell others to do. So, a place that's kind of curious is Çatalhöyük, for example, which your listeners are probably very familiar with in southern Turkey. And that dates back to, 7,000 BC or whatever. But the key point about Çatalhöyük is that the storerooms in the center of the settlement are much better built than the human habitation around them. And they were it was part of a chain of different things going up towards Mount Nimrod of the Halafian culture. Now, in my book, the whole point about Çatalhöyük is that they were storerooms. They were emporia. They were supply stations, if you like. And I can perfectly see the argument that the local people ran them, so there's plenty of evidence of what the local people did and maybe even the beliefs of the local people, but the people who may well have commissioned them and who have organized the whole thing could well have been this mysterious elite. Who knows where they actually came from? But the reason that they're there is because they want to get the stuff out of the mountains, the obsidian and all the minerals and all of that. So that to me makes perfect sense that you can have not much evidence of them.
Interesting. We seem to have quite a bit in southern Turkey specifically. As you mentioned, Çatalhöyük, we have Göbekli Tepe not too far from there as well. What's your take on this?
Well, Göbekli Tepe, I haven't yet properly processed how I think about Göbekli Tepe, because it's not quite the same as Çatalhöyük. It's not got these storerooms. It seems to be more a place much more of ritual. And from a very superficial consideration of it, there do seem to be certain parallels in the carvings and the style of carvings between that and Southern, Central and Southern America, but I could be a bit wrong about that. So who knows? I mean, the thing is, even if you've got an elite arriving in a certain place, they're still going to let the locals do things the way the locals want to do, even if they help the locals to put the stone. You know, the style of carving can still be a local style of carving. You know, you've only got to look at the modern examples of colonial powers that, you know, the British in India or whatever. It's still the Indians who influence the actual look of something. So I don't really know. And I think Göbekli Tepe is probably just one of many of strange hidden places, because they're all buried again afterwards, weren't they? That was
that's right.
The sort of oddness of it all, and there may well be an awful lot more there that we could discover. But yeah, fascinating.
What do you think about the fact then that some of these sites seems to be, at least from our perspective now, ceremonial sites, ritual sites, temples of sorts? Same thing goes with Mount Nemrut, for instance, also in Turkey. Very interesting sites. These are, you know, more religious in nature of sorts than maybe, you know, a storage facility of sorts. What's the interface there, do you think?
Well, absolutely, and also, you know, amazing sites like those in Malta, for example, as well. You know, those incredible temples there. I mean, I think the thing is that people in the ancient past had a different kind of relationship. We tend to think of spiritual as being something that we need to work on ourselves to become more spiritual and tune in and all of that to become enlightened beings. But I think the point is that in the ancient past they saw it kind of differently, because some of them were already enlightened beings. They didn't need to work on themselves, but their relationship with what we might call source, in terms of having out-of-body experiences and shamanic ritual, meant that they went on journeys, spiritual journeys, to gain practical information, practical knowledge. And this is what modern shamans still do in the jungle in Peru or Mongolian steppes or wherever. And I don't think we've understood that, because our whole take on science and knowledge has been distorted and has had to develop along a different route. We've lost touch with that use of temples and ritual and out-of-body stuff in the way that they lived it in those times.
Now I want to try to get a little closer to what type of rituals you think these were, what the point of them were, the intentions, and obviously who did them. But before we go there, just like the animals, do you think that mankind as well, or if you know what we would attribute us to today, since we seem to be talking about a different species that set this up, are we also domesticated of sorts?
Well, that's an interesting point that you raise, and it's perfectly possible that there may well have been some genetic manipulation. One of the bizarre things that people talk about is this whole, where does the blue-eyed, blonde-eyed, blonde-haired gene come from? And that seems to be traced to north of the Black Sea, to a date, I think, between 6 and 10,000 BC, although I don't know if it necessarily is as old as that. And that, I can only speculate, is possibly, for me, more evidence of contact between the civilizers who came from elsewhere and the Indo-European tribes who lived north of the Black Sea, because that's one of the things that I look at very much in the book. And there may have been some sort of interbreeding thing going on which left behind this legacy of blue eyes, blonde hair. I don't know. That's just be so fascinating to think about. I mean, not least because two particular tribes of the Indo-Europeans who were the most civilized of all the Indo-European tribes, the Celts and the Greeks, historically both had a preponderance of blue eyes. Celts still do today. The Greeks less so, because that we're talking ancient Greeks, the time of Alexander the Great. They were very much blue-eyed, blonde-haired, and you could see the legacy of that in Afghanistan, where Alexander took his troops. That's still left behind, that evidence of that.
That's right. There is even there is kind of a wave in northern Persia, as far as I understand it, as well, that even today has some of that going.
Well, that's probably as a result of Alexander the Great. That probably follows the route that he took. I wouldn't be at all surprised. But I mean, that's just speculation. You know, it would be very interesting to know more about this. I think there's more to be told from the story of DNA and genetics, without a doubt.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, of course, just in mentioning this in passing, they are trying to, they have decoded the human genome, so they say, of course, but they're trying to track and trace more. They want to have a complete genetic database, and they claim that from this that they will be able to even show and tell. They claim they can show this today where you know, your ancestors and stuff like that come from. Not too certain about how accurate all of this is, but the fact is the more data that they will inevitably gather, it's going to be more, the picture is going to get more and more clear, I think, about movements and stuff like that.
Well, the thing I was really pleased about was to discover, after I had worked out that the Indo-Europeans came from the Ukraine, somebody published, Dr. Spencer Wells published in 2004, genetic data from the National Geographic Genome Project, confirming what I said. So I thought that was rather cool, having worked it out in my head.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
To read that this guy actually confirms it, so I was really rather pleased about that. But I in the book, I look at the work of Professor Brian Sykes, who wrote a really fascinating book called Seven Daughters of Eve, where he looks at these the mitochondrial DNA of the maternal line, unbroken maternal line, and traces it back to only seven founder mothers, as it were. And these go back, the furthest goes back to 45,000 years, which ties in with Cro-Magnon arriving, and the others sort of vary in 17,000, 22,000 or whatever, but they're all over Europe. Now, what that suggests to me is that people don't necessarily move unless they absolutely have to, and that that in terms of these Indo-Europeans, the Europeans have been, some of them have been living for a very long time. We have a place in England called Cheddar Gorge, and I can't remember the exact date of Cheddar Gorge Man, but as it were, it's 6,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
DNA has shown that his descendants still live around the Bristol area, which is kind of interesting. Now, what this difference between the Brian Sykes data shows and the Dr. Spencer Wells data is that it's your mothers who are probably living in Europe. It's your fathers who probably came from the Ukraine as invaders, as soldiers. That's why we have this kind of hybrid, conflict. And people get very confused, particularly about Celts. You know, they think that Celts are somehow indigenous and that they built Stonehenge and all this kind of thing. But they didn't. They only arrived in England a few hundred years before the Romans did. You know, they're no more indigenous than the Romans are in England, or indeed in the rest of Europe. They just got here first. That was all.
There seems to be a lot of movement happening in the past as well. You have migrations taking place, of course, because of climatic changes. We have growing ice, we have receding ice, and there seems to be just a general kind of chaos, which obviously has stirred around the pot pretty well, Lucy, in that sense. So this becomes very difficult. I don't think we can say, yep, this people comes from here, or even this idea that everybody comes out of Africa either. I think it's more complicated in a sense than that.
Yeah, definitely. But you can still work it in terms of percentages, and there's still a preponderance of people from northeast India who would have come from the Ukraine. Still a preponderance of people who, in parts of Europe, who can be traced back to the Ukraine. It does stack up pretty well. And there were these different reasons for the migrations, but there was one really key one, which is the one that split up the Indo-European tribes. I mean, the reason they think the Indo-Europeans lived together is because they worked out from language that the Sanskrit has the same roots as Greek and German and Latin and all the rest of it. And so they can only have lived together, because otherwise you have a Monty Python-esque, well, that's the humour thing in this country, of people riding thousands of miles to let the Indians know that the word for X is now Y. So they must have physically lived in the same spot, because these words can be reconstructed. And I'll give you one example of one of those words, and that's a word to do with king, which is reconstructed as Reg, R-E-G. And from that you get Rex, Raj, Reich, Recht, Richt, you know, all sorts of these Indo-European words to do with rulers. And there was a massive catastrophe, global catastrophe that happened at about 3100 BC when these Indo-European tribes definitely went on the move, you know, huge diaspora. And the civilizers moved out of Mesopotamia as well. And it's after that that we get dynastic Egypt happens. It's after that that we get the Indus Valley civilization. It's after that that we get the Phoenicians. You know, all these things come from that very critical time.
Very interesting. 3100 BC, what could potentially have happened then?
Well, there's different theories, and I've looked at things like dendrochronology. I've looked at all sorts of different ways of trying to work out what it was. And it's possible this is the time... This is a time when it's the end of the Holocene climatic optimum, which was a time when deserts were actually forests. The Thar, the Gobi, and the Sahara. The Sahara was a savanna with giraffe and other creatures roaming around in it. The Thar and the Gobi were forests, and there was a lot of rainfall around at this time. And it's from this time that it's possible that the geologist Robert Schock has dated the Sphinx, because that sits in front of the Great Pyramid, because he says that the erosion on the back of the Sphinx is vertical, and that can only have come from a time of rainfall. The Nabataean pluvial dates from this time. So we had a sort of Garden of Eden type effect going on with this lovely soft climate. The equator wasn't as hot, and the northern parts weren't as cold. You know, it really was what you might call the Goldilocks time of things. Everything just about right. And it's after 3100 BC that you have raised beaches and submerged forests. So it's possible that the Earth suffered a comet strike, and there was a big wobble. And it may be the time of the flood, because rivers burst their banks and everything was massively displaced. And interestingly enough, that is also around about the time that the Mayan long count calendar is established. Mm-hmm. So it's a very, very critical time in so many ways. And
maybe as well, this is really the point where we have a formation of empires, in a sense, as well, violence and war because of lack, you know, because we have certain areas become inhabitable. You can't grow food maybe in the same place, or the food that you had in one area is no longer there, and therefore human beings begin to, obviously, well, they need to begin to migrate into different areas, or even take over a certain territory, perhaps.
Yeah, they certainly went on the move, but it was quite a long time before they arrived in, as it were, their final homelands. I mean, there were some, worse catastrophes that happened later, you know, much, much later, after the end of the Bronze Age, around 1200 BC, with the fall of Troy. You have people like the Sea Peoples who are on the move, and that is a much worse catastrophe in some ways, because it's reckoned that people got access to better weapons. You know, the secret of iron got out, and cities on the eastern Mediterranean seaboard, several of them were burnt down more than once, and awful things happened as a result of these, what they call the pirates, these sea peoples. Nobody quite knows exactly who they were. So it's quite a common thing. Egypt suffered several interruptions between 3100 BC and 1200. There were a couple of intermediary periods when the pharaohs didn't rule. One of them was the time when the Hyksos arrived and with what they call the Habiru, the Hebrews, in amongst them. That was one of these environmentally difficult times. But what was so interesting about looking at Egypt over a long period of time of several thousands of years is they were able to reestablish civilization, mostly. I mean, they weren't so successful after 1200 BC, because that was the beginning of the end, that shift from Bronze Age to Iron Age. But before that, they were able to re-establish agriculture. They stuck to their principles, and it worked for them. That's what's so interesting. And that, again, is a lesson for us. You know, if you do civilization properly, you can re-establish mostly.
Very interesting. Lots of aspects to that I want to discuss. First of all, Let's talk a little bit about what the reasons are for cities then, and compare it to, put it into perspective of farming, or let's say even the reasons why we have cities today. And you claim, of course, that there is a totally different idea behind it, one that we seem to lack today. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I think the original civilizers had this idea of cities, although they're artificial constructs, they had this idea that you could still live very much in harmony with nature, but with an awful lot more comfort for perhaps just for the elite. You know, going back to your earlier point of, you know, has mankind been genetically modified? I don't know. It's possible that they were adapted for as workers to work in cities. That's a very difficult thing. Michael Tellinger is someone who goes down that, you know, slave species of God type argument. And I mean, I don't have a particularly strong view on that. Mm-hmm. So they were looking at a different way of living that had a different kind of vibration to it. More emphasis on structure and organization. But the old one was still sensitive. It was still harmonious. Whereas what the Romans took over, because when the Latin speaking tribes arrived on the Tiber, the Etruscans were already there, and they were very much linked to the original concept of cities. They were related to the Phoenicians, and they had all the civilizing aspects. So the Latin speaking tribes effectively were like cuckoos in the nest, and took over gradually the whole Etruscan thing. And our whole view of cities really comes from that. It's like a shadow.
And the Romans didn't do it right, in a way. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, because they themselves didn't know all the secrets of shamanism. They didn't know all the techniques for manipulating nature, which is what effectively cities were doing.
Well, the Romans, sorry to interrupt, Lucy, but the Romans eradicated a lot of those things. They went around and killed the shamans in a lot of different areas of the world.
Yeah, exactly. And I wrote about this in the book, because that was one of the kind of like fascinating things, because you just assume that Romans persecuted Christians. They didn't. Long before they even became Christians, or long before they had anything to do with Christians, they were persecuting alchemists, they were persecuting Pythagoreans, they were some of the campaigns that they fought in about AD 70, for example, Mark Antony up in the Commagene, where the Hittite Empire had been in the middle of Turkey, was the last stronghold of the Chaldean Magi. There was no strategic reason to be up there, no military reason to be there. But in terms of destroying knowledge, yes, there was. And it's also, many people think, it's the reason the Romans came to Britain was to destroy the Druids.
That's right. I mean, they were up here in Goth, the Goths' land, the land of the Goths. There is even, not too far from where I'm right now, coins found a few years ago back with Vespasian on them. They had recon troops up here before they actually invaded. Well, they came with this, you know, Cistercian orders and stuff like that first to kind of scope out the area, but they definitely started up wars and eradication of peoples after that, and the natural line of kings that were here, for sure.
Yeah, no, absolutely. They were very keen on dominating in every respect, and I think for them, adopting Christianity was an absolute gift, because then they could totally control people's minds and bodies and all the rest of it. So they were definitely not on a good path. So in my book, it's not surprising the Egyptians didn't want the Romans to know all the secrets at the heart of civilization, you see. Because one mustn't forget, Henrik, that part of all of that is things like the knowledge of how to move the big stones. You know, it's powerful stuff. You know, it's not just about being loving and, sensitive towards the earth. It's about how to actually use things in our natural world in a very powerful way, deliberate manipulation.
Tell us about the moving of the stones, the techniques, what you believe was behind that, and some of the monuments we see around the world. It seems, I mean, who knows what people we can attribute this to. There are dolmens around all over the place. There's these ship settings with the stones that looks like kind of formations of ships. There's all kinds of stuff, and there we have speculations that maybe the funnel beaker culture, you know, they build it and so forth. Who do you think, and what was the reasons for this?
Well, for one thing, one must assume that people only did things because they could, because they had techniques, because it wasn't that difficult to do. I don't buy the thousands of slaves and the hemp rope argument for moving blocks that weigh, you know, 50 tons or more, 500 miles, as would have been the case in Egypt. There are all sorts of theories about were the stones at the Great Pyramid actually made out of some kind of concrete, you know, cast in situ. Well, that's possible. You know, there's some quite interesting experiments that have been done that show that that's maybe an argument. But the granite that's in the inside of the King's Chamber still would have come from the Aswan quarries, and that wasn't precast as far as I can tell.
Yeah,
and
I think it's just the outside. You're right. The kind of the casting stones are just on the perimeters. But go ahead, Lucy.
Yeah. I mean, I can see that could maybe be the argument. But you see, the thing is that for too long we didn't really assess something like the Great Pyramid with the eyes of an engineer. And now, if engineers take serious interest in the pyramid, they realise what an extraordinary engineering feat it is, and the whole thing of thousands of slaves and hemp rope, you know, pulling stuff up ramps that would be miles long. I mean, it just to something that ends up being so precise, you wouldn't even be able to see where you were building because the ramp would cover it. You know, it just doesn't stack up. There had to have been another way of doing it. There had to have been another technique. And they had to have had, I think, in my view, a way of making these stones weightless, of interfering with gravity, of allowing them to float, some sort of dipole type, you know, two magnets repelling each other, or something that they knew how to do that, and possibly even the use of lasers in the extraordinarily perfect carving, you know, all that kind of thing.
We still can't explain how how the big obelisk lying down at the Aswan quarry, how that was cut, basically. We can't explain that.
The unfinished obelisk, it has, I've seen it myself, it has these extraordinary gouges in very systematic form going down the sides, and it just doesn't stack up that anybody could hit something with another piece of dolerite or whatever it is and basically chip away at something. And how did they chip away the bit underneath it, you know, once they were going to get to that point?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, very much looked like deep carvings, using some sort of device to do that. So I think this is why the physical evidence is so interesting. You know, one doesn't need to go too much down a route of speculation in terms of, yes, they were advanced and yes, they were sophisticated, because that physical evidence is before our eyes. And we should show them more respect. We should say, wow, they really knew how to do some stuff. How did they do it? And, you know, instead of spending all these millions of pounds and dollars and francs and what have you on something like CERN and trying to split atoms, why aren't they trying to work out how people did things in the past? You know, because they clearly could achieve results, and that would possibly open up all sorts of things, of different use of energies and different power sources, and, you know, we would be living in a different kind of world.
For sure. I want to, in a while here, begin talking a little bit about the upcoming conference that you have called Eternal Knowledge. We have a few more minutes, and just maybe we can begin a lead-in on a topic that I want to continue talking more in detail about in the second hour. Basically, your idea of the what the intentions were of the ancient elite, the fact that they had a different mindset. We're talking about they had an intention of traveling, in a sense, somewhere. We're talking about shamanism. We're talking about even alchemy, actually, the use of gold. Give us a little tidbit on this, Lucy.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I think that we've kind of completely misunderstood, because we have to remember that most of what we know about the ancient past, particularly through the Egyptians, comes through the Greeks. And we've only really got the answers if the Greeks got the answers, and I don't think they got the full picture. And as a result, I think we're very confused about what things like alchemy are. Whereas I think we overlook the practical aspects of these things and how the Egyptians themselves saw it. So, yeah, I very, very much look forward to talking to you about that some more, Henrik.
There's so much more that to discuss. It's fascinating. Let's talk. Well, some of the names that you mentioned already here, in a sense, or some of the guests that are upcoming on the conference, Eternal Knowledge. Give us a little outline of what this is about.
This is really a festival of ideas. We call it Eternal Knowledge Festival, but it's really a festival of ideas, a conference under canvas, because we're going to have it in a 60-foot giant yurt on a field here. Beautiful thing. 4 tons of ash and canvas. Beautiful. We're going to cover historical background. So, as I said, Brian Foster's coming from Peru, which is brilliant, because we're going to share him with the Megalithomania event, which is happening down in Glastonbury. So very, very pleased about that. David Roll, Egyptologist, is going to be our expert on Egypt. And I've also got Marilyn Waymond and talking about Crete, and Barry Biltcliffe talking about Etruscans. But the whole point about our event is to go from the very practical, from that to the sublime, as it were. So we're going to look at things like agriculture and architecture. I've got a chap called Yannick Van Doorn. I don't know if you've come across him. He's based in the Belgium, Strasbourg area, around France. And he looks at magnetoculture and how to grow plants using electricity. And he's done some very interesting experiments. And someone I've got coming to talk about use of copper tools. Because what I'm saying is, did they deliberately choose to use copper in their production of agriculture, food? So Jane Cobbold from Implementation, she's going to talk about Schauberger and the use of copper. Andrew Goff is going to talk about bees, because he knows a lot about bees. And then we're going to go from agriculture to architecture, so like the siting of places. The Feng Shui, I have the British chairman of the Feng Shui Society, who lives in my next village. He's going to give us a talk about that, and Vastu, the Hindu version. Bob Harris, who was chairman of the Research into Lost Knowledge organization, he's going to talk about earth domes and, again, Schauberger in terms of buildings. Nick Marchmont's going to talk about sacred geometry and alchemy as well. And then I'm going to go from agriculture and architecture, geodesy, to harmonies and healing. So I've got John Stuart Reed, who's going to touch on cymatics, and Tim Wheater, who's going to talk about power of sound and DNA, Harry Oldfield and the invisible universe, and Nick Franks on radionics. So we're going to kind of like tune into those kind of subtler energies. And then I'm going to go on to physics and metaphysics. So we're going to live stream Dale Pond from the US, talk about Keeley's sacred science. John Byrd, who's a local friend of ours, is going to talk about Schauberger and Tesla. And then on the metaphysics, it's very important to understand how people thought and believed in their philosophies. We're going to really focus in on things like the Hermetica. So Peter Gandy, who's worked very closely with Tim Freake, the Glastonbury philosopher, for many years, fantastic stuff. He's going to talk about Hermetica itself. James North is going to talk about Hermetica and the Renaissance. This part of our evening entertainment is going to be Shakespeare and touching a little theme on that. Maria Wheatley on tarot, because I see the tarot as encapsulating the philosophies of the Hermetica. Graham Tobin on horary, which I think is completely fascinating, an ancient form of astrology. Anthony Thorley and Gregory Sams on kind of calendars and our approach to the sun and that kind of thing. So a totally cool event, actually, if you don't mind me saying.
Well, regular listeners will recognize some of the names there already for some of the people coming. Is about, 20 somewhat speakers?
Yeah, talk? Something like and the way we're going to structure it is some of it will be talks. We're going to do very intense mornings of talks, and then I've got these geodesic domes, hopefully, that are going to be spread around a big fire in the middle, and split people up in the afternoons to go and listen to various workshops, the sort of the tarot workshop, radionics workshop, the sound workshop, this kind of thing. So, you know, it'll be different. It's not going to be your average thing. And then I've also got fantastic art from Stephen Meakin, beautiful sacred geometry paintings. And some people are going to bring books and crystals and things like that to sell. So it will be, you know, it'll be kind of exciting. And the key thing that we want to do is have it so that everybody eats together, all the speakers and people coming eat together. So we've got local caterers who are going to supply food. So it's going to be like a very intense weekend where you really get stuck into it and, you know, meet some interesting people and exchange some interesting ideas. And then on the Sunday, we're going to close with a general forum discussion where I hope lots of the speakers will contribute and exchange between themselves, you know, because I think that's also very interesting to hear what, you know, different speakers think about each other and their work, you know. So could be really interesting. Yeah.
Sounds great, Lucy. When is it? Where is it? And what is the website, you know, to go to find out more information and tickets?
Yeah, it's called eternalknowledge.co.uk, eternal-knowledge. But if anybody Googles Eternal Knowledge Festival, they will find it. It's the last weekend in April, and it's here on my farm in Suffolk. I'm very close to a main road, the A12. I'm north of Ipswich, which is our local county town. I'm 7 minutes from a station, so we can help people with transfers if necessary. There's a little local branch line. So pretty easy to find me. And at the moment, I'm still selling tickets at a discounted price of £65 for the whole weekend, but that ends this Saturday, that particular, the 31st of March, that particular offer. So it's pretty good value, you know, because we recognize that times are hard. There's not lots of money out there, but, you know, we need to get together. We need to have these places. And I'm also offering free camping, because my field is very free draining. I've got this fantastic 25-acre field, which I've had other parties and things on. So I know how it all works, and it's not like Glastonbury Festival. No one's going to get stuck in the mud here.
I was just going to ask, how's the weather going to be? It's going to be warm and nice, do you think, at this time? Yeah.
I mean, hopefully, you know, because consistently we've had good weather at the end of April, and it's almost May. The next day, if anybody wants to stay on the Monday, we're going to do some kind of Beltane, you know, celebration, because that's the day before the 1st of May. In the evening, so, you know, we can only hope. I've had parties on the field before now in June in terrible storms, so and April has always been lovely, so I've got my fingers crossed.
Shooting for that. Sounds like a lot of fun. Again, on the website there is eternal-knowledge.co.uk. I also want to, of course, give you an opportunity to mention Approaching Chaos, your book, and give us the website for that, for people who want to, you know, pick up a copy of that.
Yeah, sure. No, it's to get a copy, they really need to Google Amazon, because it's for sale on Amazon. But if they want to look at the website, it's approachingchaos.co.uk, and they can just get a little taste of what's in the book on the website. But to actually purchase it, I mean, some places like Waterstones in Britain have had it in stock, but otherwise I think Amazon's probably the easiest thing, isn't it, these days?
It seems like it. Okay, well, Lucy, much more is to come, obviously, here. Stay with us. We're going to dive deeper into it in the next segment here. Let's take a break. We'll be right back with more in a little bit. Thank you. We begin discussing possible intentions of the ancient elite in the second hour. Lucy talks about their fascination with star systems, astral travel, alchemy, and the mining of gold. He'll explain how Roman Christian power combined to disconnect us from nature and oppress our true progress. Lucy talks about how Egyptian pharaohs went on shamanic journeys, acquiring divine right of kingship. Later we discuss the Knights Templar, the dissemination of knowledge and religion, and the followers of the Corpus Hermetica. Lucy continues about aspects of the Bronze Age civilization that reemerged at the time of the Renaissance. Lastly, we discuss the return to the archetype of the Bronze Age civilization that would be of value for us today. If you're not a member, subscribe at redeyescreations.com to listen to the next hour. I highly recommend that you try out a 3-month subscription and see if you like it. You can download everything that we have on there. It's a real treat for your mind. Wisdom, esoterica, philosophy, history, geopolitics, conspiracies, hidden agendas, mysteries, the prospect of other civilizations, new technology, and so much more. We have well over 500 programs in our archive for you. As a member, you get access to both hours through RSS feed and get the program straight into your iTunes, or you can check out our iPhone app. You can go straight to the website as new programs come out and stream it with our player, or download to your computer or mobile device to take it with you on the road. We've tried to make it as easy as possible for you. All information is on redeyescreations.com. If you have any questions, see our frequently asked questions or our help section. Next up on Red Eyes Radio, we have Håkan Blomqvist, Mike Cross, Marty Leeds, Dean Clifford, Louise Turi, J.J. Hertak and Desiree Hertak, Sterling Allen, Stefan Molyneux, Matt Stein, Jay Widener, Jordan Maxwell, William Davis and Mark Weber, to name a few. Thank you so much for listening and for your interest. We'll be back with Hour 2 now with Lucy Wyatt. Don't miss it.